Today is December 6th, and we're learning Mishlei, and the discussion at hand is the uncanny similarity between a number of proverbs in Sefer Mishlei and some ancient Egyptian proverbs. So, do what you will with that. I would be amazed if there were no similarities between Sefer Mishlei and Egyptian proverbs. Shlomo was a pretty smart guy. He read a lot, right? He was not sitting in Beis Medrash all day and all night. He went to YU. He took some courses in some comparative thought. I don't know, but forget about all that. His father-in-law was Paro. He was. I'm not saying he was steeped in Egyptian literature, but he understood it. Rav Soloveitchik said that that's the pshat in Yosef's dreams. It's not just dreams of ruling over his brothers. That's obvious. What was the focus of the dream? Why is a Hebrew dreaming about astrology or astronomy and about farming? Right? About sheaves of grain bowing to him, his sheaf of grain, or stars and the moon and the sun bowing to him. Right? What? Those are not preoccupations of a Hebrew. He should have dreamt about 11 sheep bowing to him. You get it? And then a ram or a bigger sheep. So, you know what I'm saying? Or 12 staffs of a shepherd, or 11 staffs of a shepherd bowing to him. You know the point? I get it. This father and the mother, the sun and the moon. But it is clear that Yosef is trying to impress his brothers that since we're the generation that's fulfilling the promise Hashem made to Abraham that some of your descendants will go to a strange land, we have to be prepared for that. We cannot remain in the protected walls of our cloistered environment forever, because that's not our destiny. We're supposed to go out there. You know, we're doing a lech lecha ourselves, right? And if we're not prepared for that, we're not going to do well. Okay, that's what we say. Simcha lokim kefarim b'menashe, is that we our children should be like a farim b'menashe. Even if they have to go out there and be exposed to whatever the elements are, right? The philosophical and religious elements that might be antithetical to what I taught you at home, you'll be able to hold your own. Right? Okay, v'yosef hayo b'mitzrayim. You get it? How does Rashi know from those three words? That Yosef remained the tzaddik in Mitzrayim? So it's that v'yosef hayo b'mitzrayim. You get it? He remained as he always was in Egypt. Yeah, they could have just said v'yosef b'mitzrayim. It's mazav v'yosef hayo b'mitzrayim. Means that he stayed Yosef. The Yosef that was in Canaan is the same Yosef that was in Egypt. Okay? So Shlomo HaMelech read Egyptian proverbs, and he's not going to purposely negate or avoid any of the wisdom that might be gleaned from that. Okay? The book of Proverbs mentions God many times in morality and Yiras Shamayim, but that's not particularly Jewish in nature, right? When he says, "Take my words of wisdom, tie them around your arms, tie them around your head," okay, you can make some kind of passing reference to tefillin from that, but that's a message that can fit anybody, right? Okay, so that is true about Proverbs, but it's even true about our mitzvahs. Right? When you read in an ancient code about two men fighting and the wife of one of them grabs the one fighting with her husband, and she grabs him by his privates, and it says, "Don't have any pity on her. The courts should have one of her fingers cut off." Okay? And there's a in Parshas Kisetze, there is amazingly hundreds of years after this first law appears in an ancient code, the Torah has a strikingly similar story about two men fighting. The wife of one of them grabs the other by his private parts, b'mevushav, it says in the Torah. And there it says cut off her hand, not just one finger. Cut off her whole hand. So we have the right to reserve the rendition of this mitzvah based on Torah Sheba'al Peh, that it's not talking about this case at all. It's talking about Habbalah Hargacha Hashkem V'Hargehu. Chazal derived this halacha. If you know someone is trying to kill you, you kill them first. Right? Defend yourself. So that's because we have a Torah Sheba'al Peh. Right? I think a more striking example of this is lex talionis. That's the Latin terminology for eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Right? You take out my eye, your eye is going to be taken out by the courts. The Gemara Bava Kama does have one shita. It says, ayin tachas ayin mamash. I admit that a lot of Rishonim try to work their way through, based on the Gemara itself, that he didn't really mean it that way. I mean, what good does it do for me if your eye gets taken out? I want you to pay for my eye. And a lot. It's going to be paying a lot. There's a lot of payment involved with Nezek Tzar, Yipui Shev, Boshes. You have to pay for my embarrassment for the rest of my life of wearing a patch. You've got to pay for all my loss of work. You've got to pay for my pain. You've got to pay for damages. You've got to pay for my doctor bills for the rest of my life. Right? That's a big burden. Don't take out anyone's eye. Right? Now, what's a better deterrent? That I'll lose my eye or to pay for all those things? I really don't care. Whether these things are punitive or whether they are deterrents. Torah says that there is no lex talionis when it comes to damages. Right? Now, in the ancient codes, they all deal with lex talionis. It's all lex talionis. Right? What's fascinating, hear this, and then we'll go back and go into Mishlei. What's fascinating is that when it comes to the taking of a life, the Torah is very serious. The Torah makes itself very clear that when it comes to taking a life, you with me? It is only lex talionis. Right? The Torah says take no kofar, take no replacement for a life. Right? In practically every ancient code, there is no absolute lex talionis with life. In other words, if a man from this household kills a person in the other household, this man can buy himself off by making a deal with that household. How much do you want me to pay so that you tell the courts you're okay with me making that payment and not getting killed? You get it? There is a rule somewhat like this, which is all part of the abortion debate. I don't want to get too far on this, but the Torah does say that if two men are fighting, and while they're fighting, they hit a pregnant woman, right, and it forces out the babies, it says, she loses her fetuses and it aborts the pregnancy. The husband of that woman shall sue the man and get a settlement in court for the life or lives. The Torah seems to call that unborn baby a life. All right, but it's not, because if it was, what would happen to the man who hit her? He killed. With the death penalty. So it's a debate between the Gemara Bava Kama and the Catholic Church, who understands that when it says at the end "Benasata nefesh tachas nefesh," it means the Gemara Bava Kama says it means the mother was killed. Right? The Catholic Church says it's talking about the fetus was killed, and that's what. But it's hard to fathom because they don't hold that there's a death penalty anyway, right? But okay, but I'll leave that aside. But their rendition of this story is a little different than the Gemara. And if it wasn't the class of Mishlei, I'd go through the whole differences with you. But it's all about those psukim, about what's the ason that causes the courts to determine that the man who hit her shall die. Right? So we have lex talionis bedafka on life. And in the ancient world, practically every ancient code has the rule that you can buy off, you buy yourself off from the death penalty for murder. But when it comes to damages, we flip, you get it? When it comes to damages, it's almost exclusively lex talionis in the ancient world. And we, bedafka, we have a Torah Shebaal Peh. You hear? Now, is it possible that originally it really meant ayin tachas ayin, but Torah Shebaal Peh? I don't know. The Torah Shebaal Peh comes from Har Sinai also. Does Torah Shebaal Peh change over time? Isn't that getting into dangerous places? That originally ayin tachas ayin meant mamash, because we were actually, you know, after all, slave mentality. We might have been fighting more. We needed more of a deterrent. This frame of reference considers a greater deterrence from me taking out, chas v'shalom, taking out your eye, that I'm going to lose my eye, then I have to pay for all those things I mentioned 5 minutes ago. The slaves needed a greater deterrence. It was mamish. But then later, when we became more, we moved into communities and we became more, working with one another, and so then it became ayin tachas ayin, not mamash. Okay, I must confess, there is I consider a very traditional commentary. It's called Shmuel David Lutzato. He says he finds a few of the mitzvahs of the Torah, where the Torah Shebaal Peh says A when they were in the Midbar, and something changes when they get to Israel. So, with all due sincerity, the one I'm about to mention to you is actually in the Vilna Gaon. He says that there is nothing in the Torah that says that the goat that you send out into the desert on Yom Kippur, you with me on this, everybody? Remember what we call that goat?
Azazel.
Azazel, right? That goat, it just says in the Torah, send it out into the desert. The Gemara says, what do you do with it? You should throw it off a cliff. Gemara says that's where the cliff meets, Azazel, a rocky cliff. So I'll take him to the Azazel, which I think you can produce an Israeli terminology. Where did the Torah Shebaal Peh get that you throw it off a cliff? Show me a pasuk in Parshas Acharemos that says so. Right? So Shaddal says something very interesting. He says that when we got to Israel, the place where you would send this goat away was in Shiloh, and then in Yerushalayim. So there's a very big difference than Yom Kippur in the desert, than Yom Kippur in Israel. Yom Kippur in the desert, you just send the goat away, it's going to go far into the desert. But in Israel, if you send the goat away from Shiloh, where's it going to go? It's going to go into another community, and someone's going to find it and eat it. It's kachim, it's a carbon. Right? You know what I'm saying here? So it's, when you got to Israel, you had to make sure that goat dies, so that no one comes to use it. But in the desert, we're all in a small camp, relatively speaking. You shouldn't send it over the desert. It's no one's going to see that goat again. It's safe to assume that no one's going to be finding it and eating it. You follow what I'm saying? So it could be that a Torah Shebaal Peh comes to tell us that this is the way it's supposed to be now, because this is the Metzias in the desert. And when you get to Eretz Yisrael, it's going to be something different. The Meshech Chochma and the Netziv is very good at finding those hints in the Pasuk itself. Right? The purpose of this entire introduction I'm giving you is to sort of wet your feet to the inyan of comparative references in ancient Near Eastern literature that predates the books, whatever book you're studying, right? And the book itself, right? Generally, there are three different types of comparisons. Okay, they are. I'm using Akkadian words. Dinu, kapsu, and shapru. Right, but I'm not sure if even one of these actually fits Mishlei. But then dinu, kapsu. Shapru means dinu are dinim. If you find a code from Sumeria about what happens if your ox gores someone else's ox, that's an example of din. You see the word din in there, right? Okay? Kapsu are texts of rituals. Okay? If you see a text from Babylonia, what do you do when it doesn't rain for 6 months in a row, when we're chalashim for rain, or the Euphrates seems to be drying up? So the high priest tells you that you've got to go out. Everyone older than six has to go out with and bear these feathers and wave them together and say the following, and you know, and then jump three times in the air. You know what I'm saying? Right? So that's kapsu. That's a ritual, right? Which book of the Torah is our main book of Kapsim, right? Yigur, of course, right? Okay, so Shapru are like, you know, legends or stories, you know. Okay. Now, there's what Mishlei falls into, what we fancy word we usually give to it, is called sapiential literature. You see the word homo sapien in there? Like wisdom literature. Things that tell you how to navigate the human experience. Okay? Of course, all three of these are supposed to help you do that. Right? Okay. Just an interesting last note on this. This is, a lot of side issues today, is that there, we have still not yet found in all of the history of archaeology, 200 years old or so, right? We have not found a single document from the ancient Near East that has any two of these in the same document. You know what I'm saying? If we find a treasure trove on one stone of all kinds of dinim, right? Or we find a whole series of documents, of contracts, or the way we do business in this place 3,000 years ago, right? Those are din. You're not going to find rituals in that source. You following? It's true that the books of the Torah seem to take sides. It would appear that Horatius is certainly Shapru, right? Horatius decidedly doesn't have too much of the other two in it, right? Well, I would say Shmos has all three of them. But Midbar has all three of them. Dvarim, not so much on the Shapru side, but it certainly has Kapsu and Dinu. Right? In other words, you don't find a text, an Egyptian text, that tells what should a pregnant woman do as she's going into labor. What rituals should she do to assure a safe labor and a healthy child? That would be Kapsu, right? It's a Dinu. So in the Shapru. Right, there's a cups. What rituals should she perform? Right, so you're not going to find dinim attached to such a text. Right, so 4 pesukim later, it's not going to say, you know, what do you do if an ox gores or something? Yeah, okay. But I tell you this, in Shmos, a pasuk that talks about civil law, a few pesukim later, talks about getting rid of witchcraft, which is certainly kapsu. Right? The pasuk right before "Ve'ahavta lo'recha kamocha" in the Torah, which is, would appear to be like a dinu kind of thing, right? The pasuk right before that in the Torah is "Don't wear shabbos," which is very kapsu, right? Very ritualistic. Okay, so what's the takeaway from that?
Can't have one without the other.
Yeah, for us, ritual is din, and din is even more important. Din is ritual. You know what I'm saying? Din is for us in the ancient world, ritual is much more important than din. And you can see why, because what I do for my God, if I'm a Sumerian or a Babylonian, is to do everything my high priest tells me to do to strengthen my God as much as possible, to be a cog in that wheel that turns the effect and the strength of my God, so that at our next war he makes us victorious. He makes our crops grow well. He gives us the rain we need, right? So, of course, it makes perfect sense that if I feel that in order for me to do that, I have to steal from you to bring my God a sacrifice, you know, it fits that I should do so. Which is explains why Yeshayahu says, I despise, it's pasuk, sonei gezel be'ola. I despise an ola brought with ill-begotten gains. Okay? Don't steal in order to do my rituals. Right? But it makes perfect sense for... a Sumerian doesn't think stealing is good. No. No societies believe that it's good for everybody to steal. Right? But there are always, you know, relative behaviors that I have to make decisions. Right? Okay. Look, we're not so far from this. We also believe that our behavior will determine whether my next war is successful or not. We say for Divrei Hayamim, it's in every fifth pasuk at a certain point. The Divrei Hayamim is correlating the behavior of the king and his people and their next battle or their next crop or something like that, the successes. It's really the agenda of Divrei Hayamim, to correlate your behavior with God's treatment of you. Shabbos, that's the point of the Bible. Right? You know, a book like Koheles is written because they don't always correlate in our experiences. Life does not seem to be fair. Right? The answer our Talmud will give us, or even some of Mishlei might give us, is that it all evens out. It evens out at some point. Good people will always be rewarded, and good things always end up winning in the end. Good always triumphs over evil, which explains the great popularity of Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, and other things like that. Right? So, Koheles does not want to rely on anything that's not empirically answered. Right? I see good people suffering, so I can't just give God a pass on that. Right? Of course, at the end of the book, he ends up doing just that. He just says, be moral no matter what. In the end, he says, sof davar, kol nishma. Whatever that means. It means in the end, everything will be not nishma heard, but understood. Okay. When shema in the Torah means to just hear something, it means the targum is shema. When Targum wants it to mean understood and to accept, be accepted, it's kabel, kuf bet lamed. Okay, like when Yehuda says, "Let's save him. Let's not kill him. Let's put him. Let's sell him." So it says, "Vayishmu echav." The brothers heard Yehuda. That means not just that they heard him. Are you telling me that they had power of hearing? They heard him means they accepted it. You get it? Okay, okay, that's all our tangents and all of our preparations. It should not, because this is a part of your assignment, it should not surprise us. In fact, it would surprise me if Mishlei did not have influence from Egyptian proverbs. Okay, all right. So let's take a look now at. The last page of what I gave you. Okay. I'm indebted to Dr. Orlean for... I had my own list, but it's handwritten, so this is a lot easier to go through. Okay, see how Koteres... You can get this? The Koteres which means the heading. He said the purpose of the book is just chapter 1, verses 1 through 9. Remember one of the first days of class, he said it could be the first 10 chapters are all trying to tell you why it's important to read this book. Because we see psukim even later, chapter 3, 4, that are like introductory to the point that it still tells us what the book is about. What is, you know what I'm saying? Like, a pasuk that says something like, Kihu yomecha v'orech, Kihu chayecha v'orech yomecha, isn't really a proverb. It's trying to tell me why I should accept these proverbs. Why? Because it's Kihu yomecha, chayecha v'orech yomecha. Behold, Rachecha Da'ehu, you should know God in all your ways. Remember, at the very beginning of the semester, I said that chapter 4 has all these worldview psukim in it. Remember, we talked one class, we did the psukim that encapsulate the Torah, right? There's like 8 or 9 psukim found throughout Chazal about the most important psukim, right? What would you tell a convert that wanted to hear the whole Torah and, you know, while he's standing on one foot? Right? Right? Things like that. So good. So here we have the Koteres is really Perek Aleph through Tes. Right? Okay. And then if you go straight into Pasuk Yud, the Mesorah, by the way, seems to disagree with this. You see the Mesorah, if you're looking in this Tanakh, you see, on Pasuk Zion, it ends, and then Ches Tes Yud Yud Aleph. There is a method to how these pages were. There's a Masoretic ending to Pasuk Zion, implying that this is the end of the situation here. But the Masorah has to. You know this, you see Shema B'ni Musar Abicha V'al Titosh Torah Simecha. Remember we showed once, we went through all the prakim, the first 10 prakim, how a message to a son is opens up each new section. Right? Alright, look, you can't help but see that starting with Pasuk Yud, these are not single proverbs. It's a whole section, psukim that go one after the other. This is not the nature of the entire book. Most of the book just has a proverb, and the next pasuk is another proverb. Right? Here, from pasuk Yud all the way up to pasuk Yud Tes, is this author telling us how to avoid an association with bad people. Right? We are social creatures. Right? Sometimes the pressures are too great. Right? Once saw someone wearing a t-shirt that says, "I'm the kid your parents said not to stick around, you know, to hang with." You know? How's that for a shirt, right? So it's just saying, you know, first thing is, Pick your friends. You're a social creature. You're going to behave like them. I might say pick your books too. Book is a friend. You know, a lot of people are shaped by some early books that they read. Okay? So that's where there's a lot of manifestations of what this means. Right? Okay? All right? Okay, so then look at 3. So then Chochma is actually speaking to the person. But be careful. While, of course, Mishle personifies Chochma, and that's a great start to your life. Right? You have to be very careful, because Sefer Koheles tells us that there is a much higher ideal than Chochma. And Pirkei Avos really, really elaborates on it to a great extent. Pirkei Avos says, if your chachma precedes your yira, your chachma will fail you. If your yira precedes your chachma, you will survive. Both of them will survive. What does yira mean in that sense?
Yerushalayim.
Understood. What does Yerushalmai mean then? Fear of God. What does that mean?
The context are more knowledgeable in God.
It's morality. In other words, your chachma should point towards morality. Now, I'll admit that if we read through the entire Plato's Republic, we'll see that there are very different opinions of what is considered morally just. Right? There was a... they made a play out of this. I think the play is called Irina? I'm not sure, but Irina, I think, is the name of the play. About a Polish woman who hid scores of Jews under a large villa, a large mansion, where she was the maid. Whole families were put into a secret hideaway downstairs, and she brought them food throughout the war, and she took care of their excrements and took them, cleaned it, and for the whole time. And what happened, you know, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, when they came to a new place, they would seize the large houses for their headquarters. And so this villa was actually used for the local Nazi headquarters for their strategies. So that on any day there were 100, you know, SS men in this villa. And throughout the war, this woman took care of this family. So what happened? It's an amazing story. You gotta Google the story. It's a really amazing story. It's a true story. In fact, the daughter of this Irina came, our shul went to see it. The daughter of this woman came to see the film with talk, and she talked to us afterwards. She made it to America after the war, and she moved to California. I don't believe the woman herself is still alive, but her daughter seemed to be like in her 60s or 70s, and probably older, right? What happened was that the commandant, the colonel, or whatever it was, the Nazi, learned of it. Forget it, it's a death sentence for all 40 of them, whoever were there. A child was born in that, there, in that hideaway. Right? The child moved to, the family with the child moved to Israel. They all survived. When this Nazi commandant found out about it, imagine this, she was able to convince him to allow it to continue. She said, look, you see, the war is lost. Think about your legacy after the war. Think about what they're going to say about you. And he let it go on the condition that she becomes his mistress. There are actual pictures of her. She was strikingly beautiful. And she agreed. She wasn't married. She was like a teenager. She was like 19. Right? She agreed. She slept with him for the rest of the war. The war was lost. Everyone down there survived. I'm only telling you this because after the war, this Nazi, this colonel, was so excoriated as a traitor in Germany. He was despised. He couldn't get a job. No one would rent him a house. Right? There's usually a big pension for colonels, you know, after a war is over. Right? You go back to regular life. This guy was so despised. Get this? The family of the boy that was born in moved to Israel and took him in. This Nazi lived out the rest of his life in Israel. And the boy called him Zadie. It's all in the film. It's all in the play at the end, at that part at the end. Crazy story, right? You gotta see, I think it's called Irina. Look, you know, maybe if you can look it up and see, is there such a thing? You see it? I don't know if you want to look it up afterwards. I know we don't have our, you know, our computer guy here. All right, so why am I telling you this? Is that the war is over. You look at what you did. Because they saw what they did to the Jews as morally correct. So that if someone allows Jews to live when our law says it's supposed to kill them, that person is traitorous. That person is helped destroy our dream of creating a 1,000-year society. That's the way the Nazi looks at it. And if the point of this story is that if that was the case during the war or before the war, It was surprisingly the case even after the war in a lot of places. That being said, I just want you to know that a few nights ago at the Brandenburg Gate, a huge menorah was lit by the president of Germany. I think his last name sounds Jewish. It's Steinmeier, but I don't think he's Jewish. The president of Germany lit a huge menorah at the top of the Brandenburg Gate, where Hitler gave his speeches, where he... Amazing. All right, I'm just saying that there could be a new sense of morality. Okay, morality may be subjective. I'm sure it is. Right, but what the observant Jew has is to say, I agree. I would be very hard pressed to come up with an independent definition of morality myself. I have the Torah. Okay. I have the Torah. The Torah tells me what morality is. Right? I run into it. What are we supposed to do with Amalek, the seven Canaanite nations? Those are issues, right?
Have there been issues with any moral peace?
So, the way I understand is that if I have multiple opinions, I have Tosfos and Sota and Megillah, I have a Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, I have a Ramban at the end in Parshas Shoftim, I have Rashi in many places in the Torah, I will reserve the right myself, as you should, to choose the commentary of these two that emerged from these four that I mentioned, and there are 100 others, of what I understand the Torah's mitzvah to be in these sections, based on my I don't have a totally subjective position on morality. My moral positions are created by the sources I read in Chazal and in the Mefarshim to Chazal. Rashi basically says every Amalekite and every Canaanite had basically two choices: you can leave, or we'll kill you.
Yeah.
Even in Amalek. In other words, if you don't have a chiyuv to go down to Australia and chase after Amalekim, right? So, Ramban very clearly, very, very sharply disagrees with this. Ramban says that all the Canaanite nations, and including Amalek, were given the opportunity to perform seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach and remain with us, or perform 613 mitzvahs, and convert and join us and be our brothers. Rambam says that, and even Amalek, the Rambam says there's no war that should ever be fought without first trying to extend the arm of peace. There's no such thing as a surprise attack. Even the Six-Day War, Israel sent warnings throughout May. This is what we're going to have to do if you don't open up those straits at Tehran. Lyndon Johnson warned them, don't you dare go to war unilaterally. The same way Barack Obama prevented a war in Iran seven years ago. Right? They were ready to go in. Who knows what would have happened? I don't know. I was against going in because I have kids who live in the north, and the missiles were going to fly down from Hezbollah on unpopulated areas. And Israel probably would have had to respond with something nuclear or something, I don't know. Something very bad. I don't know. You know, it's a tight spot. And Hamas and Hezbollah know that. In other words, they're relying on our morality of not doing to them what their own people usually do to them. You know, the tunnels in Hamas, what did Egypt do to one of the tunnels? They cascaded in poison water, like mamish bleach, and they just wiped out 20, 30 people with a horrific death. And Israel can do that all the time, but we don't do it because it's not a moral way to do things. That's what they do themselves to their people. Look at all corners of the look what Saudi Arabia does to Muslims in Yemen. Look what Syria is doing to their own people. Look what Afghanistan. Look at it. It's their own people, right? Okay, so that's on Chochmah and Yira. We are very wary of Chochmah without Yira. I think we discussed that in this class. I'd be amazed if Chochmah alone defines what the society will do. I'd be amazed if if the world would not create a Nazi kind of what do you think the word Nazi means? Nationalistic, but what socialistic? Right? It's not National Socialist Party. They wanted everyone to be beholden to the government. Right? So it's the giver. If your head does not measure up, we're gonna put your stringe in your head and put you in a box and throw you unthinkingly down the chute. That's chachma without yira is natural. That's what it's going to turn to. And don't be surprised that their main enemy was the Jew, because the Nazis knew the Jew would not allow them. Okay, all right. Okay, everybody, shkayach gadol. We're going to continue with number 4 next time. Bring this sheet in.